and what are the world's leading authorities on black holes? And in the second half of Exploration, we brought on Professor Richard Gott of Princeton University, who, believe it or not, has his own particular design for going backwards in time. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics here in New York City. Check out my website, www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What, do you want me to do a bunch of them?
On the Rape Decoration Forum today, sex scandal donations and low-wage workers self-organizing over sexual harassment. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. We reached out to Terry Rosenberg from the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault when the New York Post reported they were alleged to be the recipient of a $10,000 donation from the former Republican Party finance chair, Steve Wynn, who had donated the amount to the New York Republican Party. We wanted to find out more and talk to Terry Rosenberg.
What initially prompted my call was that I had seen the New York Post story after the latest sexual assault scandal had broken out about the billionaire Steve Wynn, who was recently appointed the Republican National Committee finance chair. The story came out in the Wall Street Journal. The New York Republican Party stated they were donating $10,000 to NACASA, and I wanted to find out whether there was any truth in that and also how the organization felt about being the recipient of the money.
Sure. Well, we as an organization found out the same way you did through the post. So it was certainly a surprise to us. We didn't know that was going to be happening. And so we were certainly surprised. As a 501c3 organization, by law, we are nonpartisan. So in terms of, you know, whether or not to, you know, accept the money, that's not really a discussion that
yes.
we can have. But
yes.
at the same time, you know, donations like this allow us to extend services to all survivors of sexual assault, regardless of their backgrounds, as well as efforts to stop sexual assault in marginalized community. And we tend to, you know, use this money, you know, in this way as we would any other donation.
And since this movement of Me Too and the very public statements that are being made by so many people, have you found that donations have increased to your organization?
Slightly, not that much. I would say slightly. I mean, I think with the, you know, rise of the Me Too movement, it is, you know, wonderful that it brings attention to our cause and certainly to our organization, but there's also then the rise of new organizations that come out of it, like Time's Up, which is, you know, a great initiative, but certainly a place also where, you know, funds may be funneled to. So I think that it's always, in terms of specifically the fundraising, because in general it's obviously, you know, an important movement, but specifically in terms of the fundraising, it's always a double-edged sword.
Yes, that's interesting. There's a lot of coverage on these, you know, the public statements being made and the courage of so many women to come forward, and men. Some men are coming forward too. But I'm wondering about, I have heard before sometimes the problems with this, is, you know, district attorneys won't take a case to court because of he said, she said in cases where rape is reported or sexual assault is reported. I'm just wondering about whether you're hearing anything about laws being changed or being reviewed, or if there's been any sort of discussion on that that you've heard.
I mean, I know that there, you know, certainly are discussions happening about, you know, how we, you know, about how different systems handle sexual assault investigations, whether that be the DA's office or the NYPD. And when things come up, I've seen those systems try to be responsive. There was just an incident late last year where it came out that a police officer sexually assaulted a person who was in their custody. And
yes.
after that, quickly, I mean, it would stand to reason that something like this would already exist, but a law was created that you cannot have sex with somebody who is in custody. So I've seen these systems respond to things that have been happening. And I know there has been media coverage on the New York DA's, the Manhattan DA's office after the Harvey Weinstein investigations broke. So I haven't heard any reports of large-scale change, but I know those conversations are happening and hopefully will lead to further rights for survivors.
How is the sort of Me Too movement and the Time's Up organization, are you getting more calls than you used to for people seeking help because it's encouraging them to come forward?
I think it's a similar situation. We have seen a slight uptick in calls, not quite the uptick that we saw surrounding either the Access Hollywood tapes or the election back in 2016. We saw a higher increase then. But we have seen an increased interest in training, which is very encouraging to us, that other corporations and colleges are coming to us wanting our help and expertise, so to make sure incidents like this don't happen at their institutions in the future.
So they're seeking you out for training of their staff or their administrators in how to handle when these cases are reported to by the students?
And how to help prevent it happening in the first place, yes.
And what are some of the methods for trying to prevent it happening in the first place?
Well, as an organization, we talk a lot of, we have several presentations that focus on topics like consent. So I know a lot of this and the murky areas around that came up around the Aziz Ansari story. So we essentially talk to usually students about how to talk about sex and how to talk about communication within a relationship, so that way these things don't happen going forward and people can address these issues in an open and healthy way before it ever leads to assault. We also talk about bystander intervention in ways that you just as a person or as a friend can help prevent assault in progress when you see, whether that's, you know, calling somebody in a position of authority or doing something to distract them from the situation, or just going up and pretending you know somebody and asking them to go to the bathroom with you. So we talk a lot about strategies like that that people can start at any time to help prevent future assaults from happening.
Yes, I think I have enough for this piece, but thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
That was Terry Rosenberg from the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault, a non-profit group that offers training programs and carries out original research into sexual assault, the causes and how to prevent it.
Yeah.
And that was the Pointer Sisters, a hit from 45 years ago. The track there was called Yes, We Can Can. I was reminded about it from by Nina Paley, who calls herself a grumpy middle-aged artist. She'd posted a wonderful video of 24 ancient female goddess statues dancing to that track. It's quite extraordinary to see, if you can check it out. The name is Nina Paley. It's done very well, and it's got a lot of hits on social media. And interesting, that song has new meaning for today. And you've been listening to the Rape Declaration Forum on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. A recent story in Labour Notes said that while there is a great deal of public disclosure from movie stars and celebrities, often overlooked was the pervasiveness of sexual assault and sexual harassment in lower paid jobs. Reporter Jenny Brown covered hotel, restaurant and airline workers for Labour Notes and shares with us some of what they experienced and how some wage, low-wage workers self-organised around sexual harassment.
3 years ago, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said that the restaurant industry's largest source of sexual harassment, and this was backed up by a survey conducted by the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which in a national survey of over 4,300 restaurants, found that more than one in 10 reported they'd experienced sexual harassment by co-workers. The survey takers found that sexual harassment was accepted and considered part of the culture. So, Jenny, from your own writing, when you've reported on hotels, restaurants, and airlines, do you consider that more than one in 10 claiming sexual harassment is underreporting?
I expect that's right. Of course, servers in restaurants also experience sexual harassment from the customers. So when they report coworkers, one in ten, and then probably for servers, it's everybody has experienced some level of harassment, whether it's being called pet names, being groped, all the way up to being followed home when you get off your shift, and violence. So I would say that it is underreporting.
That was a survey of restaurants, but are there similar instances that you know of happening in airlines with farm workers, with hotel workers?
So for farm workers, where there isn't an organization, it's rampant. Now, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is an organization of tomato pickers in Florida, has been able through a 20-year campaign to really raise standards in their industry. And sexual harassment has been one of the top things that they've been trying to counter, because women are often isolated in the fields. They have very few job protections. About a third of the CIW's members may be undocumented, so then there's the extra threat that I will get you deported. So for those workers, really the solution has been to get a three-way agreement between the customers who buy the tomatoes, the farms that employ the workers, and the workers themselves. Needless to say, there's been great resistance on all sides. So it's taken a long time, but what it has resulted in, I think, is very optimistic, which is that when you have teeth in a program, you can crack down on this kind of behavior among managers and bosses, even in a very unregulated and not unionized situation. So when farms do not respond to the sexual harassment complaint, they can be kicked out of the Fair Food Program and lose important customers. So that gives the higher management a reason to take complaint seriously and deal with managers who are sexually harassing the workers. They also have an enormous amount of training that they estimate that over half of the farm workers in the tomato fields in Florida have gone through a coalition of remarkably workers training around their rights on the job, including against sexual harassment. So their idea is that the workers themselves have to be the enforcers and everybody has to watch out for each other in the field. And the, you know, so that has also been quite successful. Now, in airlines, it's interesting, right, because airlines started out essentially inviting sexual harassment of their staff. You know, that the ads would say, you know, fly me and all of these sort of provocative things. So you had to be single, you had to have a certain look, you had to weigh in at work. That was true until the early 90s. At 32, you were fired because you were considered over the hill. What changed in that industry is that they organized the union. And so a majority of flight attendants in the U.S. now have a union, and that, of course, raises standards for non-union airlines like Delta, which the flight attendants have been trying to organize a union but haven't been successful. So they were able to finally get rid of some of these things like getting fired at a particular age. They were able to get rid of the weigh-in. You could be grounded and essentially suspended without pay if you gain 5 pounds, this kind of thing. And it doesn't mean that there's no sexual harassment, but they do have a very good system for reporting. They have employee assistance programs. They are on it. And I think part of that is that it's a majority woman workforce. Because unionization is not the magic bullet. We saw a couple of days ago the New York Times had a front page story about workers at the Ford assembly plant in Chicago. This plant, I covered sexual harassment there 3 years ago. They have had waves of women complaining about horrible working conditions, hostile working conditions created by their managers and even their coworkers in the plant, where, you know, pictures of people's penises are pasted up at their work site. They're gross. Mm-hmm. They're rubbed up against while they're trying to work. They're, you know, lewd comments, really hostile stuff that just make it extremely difficult to work. And then when they report it, they get retaliation, and the union has been complicit in this. In fact, some of the harassers, the accused harassers, have official positions in the union. So their strategy has been to go through the EEOC and to through the company, and they, with some success, they've actually been able to get on two occasions in the 90s, and also recently they've been able to get the company to cough up money and also to change its behavior and put inspectors in and sort of, you know, tamp down this really hostile environment for women, who are about one in three to one in four workers in the plants are women. So they have actually been able to tamp it down. But what the women at Ford say is that it will go back up again, these problems will continue unless fundamental things are changed about how the workplace is. And one of the things about the U.S. is that we have such terrible employment law. For example, in the absence of a union, you are an at-will employee. This is maybe unfamiliar to people in other countries. You can be fired for any reason or no reason, unless it's a particular protected category, such as sex, race, or you're trying to organize a union, and then of course it's very hard to prove. But workers can be fired for any reason. So this puts a terrible pressure on women employees when they are being harassed. To complain means losing your job, almost certainly. And so so the whole employment situation in the U.S. is complicit in you know, creating these bosses and managers petty positions of power where they really have control over your livelihood. And also, we don't have a very good or any social safety net in the U.S. When you do get fired, You can't get unemployment compensation if you've been fired. Your health care is dependent on your job because we don't have a universal health care system. So all of these things, you're dependent on that paycheck, but also on your housing and your health care are dependent on that paycheck also. So it puts women in an extremely vulnerable position, and it's very difficult to make a complaint under those circumstances or stand up to your employers. So those are some of the things that are a little bit unique in a advanced industrialized country for us.
I was reading that the Restaurant Opportunity Center looked at sexual harassment settlements over a four-year period and verdicts, and found a lot of those were filed against major chains like McDonald's and KFC and IHOP and Applebee's and Denny's. What's going on when you have a fast food industry corporation that's quarterly reports have, vetted by Wall Street and must have a corporate policy in place and has to adhere to federal laws because they're a nationwide chain? What's going on there where these things are, it takes having to go and file a lawsuit against the organization?
Well, the labor law is pretty weak in this country, and it's also very lightly enforced. So even when you register a complaint, you really have to go through a lot of effort. But the reason that they're able to sometimes get settlements from these large companies is that you can show a pattern of discrimination and a pattern of not taking these complaints seriously. You can show a pattern across many stores, whereas if it's just one store, you can say, oh, well, that was just one individual manager. It's not really the company's fault. But they have actually been able to prove that they're just completely nowhere on protecting their employees who are getting harassed. And so that has been, but again, it would be better to have the laws enforced and to have a union on the job that could defend these workers rather than having to go to a several year lawsuit process. And and meanwhile, the workers are, many of them, out of a job. The law is sort of, you can follow it up later, but it doesn't really, it's not as good as actually having some form of defense, which is, fast food workers have been trying to get union for a long time. And, the fight for 15 is a fight for 15 and a union. And one of the things you get with a union is that workers can get together and say, no, this stops now, and can actually do direct on the job actions around it. So that is ultimately going to be what, along with winning better protections for workers when they get laid off, I think that is going to ultimately really be what cracks down on this stuff.
Yes. And what about women working in the hotel trades? Of course, there was this scandal with the head of the IMF who was accused of raping a maid in New York. In the end, the case either was settled privately or I think it was settled. But is it pervasive again in the hotel trades as it is in restaurants and bars?
Yeah, when that happened, when Dominique Strauss-Kahn got accused of raping this hotel housekeeper, the hotel union Unite Here did a series of speakouts of hotel workers around the country. And what they found is that many hotel workers have had similar experiences of guests groping them, coming to the door naked, asking them to be tucked in, asking them to give massages, this kind of thing. And it's actually extremely common. What the hotel workers have been able to do in unionized hotels, they have been able to get strengthened contracts, but they've also been able to, in Seattle, they got an initiative passed which requires hotels to keep lists of guests that have had complaints against them. And if they're repeat offenders, the hotels have to ban them from their hotels.
Oh.
So there's actually that the initiative has several different parts for hotel workers, but and sexual harassment is just part of that. The other things that hotel workers have demanded is to not have to wear a skirt. But, you know, this they prefer a tunic and pants, not because it's provocative, but because it just gives you more protection against getting groped. Right, you're leaning over a tub in a skirt. It's just like So they've demanded that. They've demanded panic buttons in some hotels where you can just press it and immediately security arrives. So that gives you some sense that, you know, it can only go so far. It's still not a defense against the beginning of it, but it does help. The other thing is that understaffing is really a big problem when it comes to assault, because if you have two workers cleaning a hotel room, it's much less likely to be an assault in that case than if there are one. So for some housekeepers have said, you know, they want to be able to leave the door open and put the cart in the door so that the guests can't come in and close the door behind them. And then also working two at a time in a room so that you have a coworker there and you can defend each other. That kind of thing. So there are a lot of techniques that they've come up with in terms of getting more protection on the job there. Of course, hotel workers have a lot of different struggles, including, you know, this incredibly high workload, having to change so many beds a day that they get repetitive strain injuries in their arms. So there are a lot of struggles on the job, but that's one of the ones that they've been focusing on.
Mm. Before the hashtag MeToo took off, there was a Canadian writer called Anne Donoghue who posted a tweet, and it started off, "When did you meet your Harvey Weinstein?" And she described a personal thing that at the age of 17 where her boss would massage her shoulders as she typed. And initially, people started posting, and she started to respond to the post like, "I'm sorry this happened to you." And then she couldn't keep up because the post went viral, as you would expect, with responses from women. And the last count was like 5,000 women responded, with the driving instructor, the professor, the school teacher, the bar boss who used to sort of press himself against them or jingle their change or look down their blouses or all sorts of things that went on. And this was then retweeted 5,000 times and liked by 14,000. So you know the ones that are liking it, 14,000, is people that this has happened, but they don't want to say anything.
Right.
In instances, so we see now this is pervasive across every industry. If there isn't a union in place, and you've mentioned some extraordinary examples of where people are able to, you know, get help because there is a union and training, but what do you have any answers for what workers can do to protect themselves? Is the answer always to go and report a human rights violation or seek a lawyer's help? Is that the best thing, or is there something that's proactive that can happen in the office or between small groups of women? And I'm just wondering, because of the work that you're doing with the National Women's Liberation Organization, whether you're being asked to like come up with ideas around that idea of, you know, is there something that women can do to get together in offices or in a bar?
Absolutely. I mean, the essence of a union is coworkers getting together to change something that they want fixed, right? So you don't have to have a formal union. I think in these cases, women need to talk to each other and compare notes and tell each other immediately when something happens. And, you know, that could lead to some more organizing or direct action on the job. If somebody is consistently harassing people on the job, you know, we need to get together and first of all, communicate with each other. And I understand that many jobs are competitive and we're set up against each other and we're not supposed to talk about work complaints because, oh, you'll be the troublemaker. But I think this is the moment when we can see how pervasive this is, that we can really start to talk to each other as people who really need to get together and change this and stop it from happening.
Yes. I remember there was an interview I was listening to with Lynn Farley, the woman who coined the phrase sexual harassment before it really had a name. It's like 37 years ago. She wrote a book about it, and it was the term that was used to fight the first lawsuit filed by a black woman against her boss. The reason I mentioned Lynn Farley is that one of the suggestions she had about what to do about this was to create something called the Women's Labor Union, where there would be, I guess, an international organization with dues paid, the mandate was to fight for women who work. And there was a sort of purity in that idea, and I wondered why it never happened, because presumably it was talked about at the time, and whether you envision something like that could happen, because then they could be bought in to say, look, the culture in this office, you know, doesn't work. This culture in this movie studio doesn't work.
Our thought in National Women's Liberation, our belief is that women all need to join a feminist organization and pay dues and have an independent power base, not necessarily for just one workplace, but across workplaces and ultimately internationally, although we also feel that, you know, in each country we have to fight our own male supremacists. But, you know, the idea of an independent power base is very much what the women's liberation movement thought of originally, is that, you know, you would have women would get together and this would be a way to stop all of the range of things that are happening to us in terms of discrimination, sexism, taking our work for granted, all the free labor that we provide, you know, and would fight for all the whole range of things that we need. I don't know if that's similar to what Lynn Farley was talking about, but certainly we do need some form of independent organization, and we our position is that they need to be funded by the women who are in them, as opposed to grant funded. A lot of stuff in the U.S. ends up being grant funded, and then it ends up having the priorities of the funders as opposed to the priorities of the membership. So we think, you know, independence is very important, and that we need to be paying dues to our feminist union, as it were, as well as if we can organize a union at work, we need to be paying dues to that, because there are so many things that a union at work can do, not least fight for, against these problems of sexual harassment, and defend you when they're going to fire you for complaining, because without a union, you really are stuck. And then the other thing is that we need to change the employment conditions in the U.S. I mean, one thing that was very interesting about the Restaurant Opportunity Center surveys that they've done over the years is that for workers who have a tipped minimum wage, the harassment is much worse, because essentially every customer is paying you, right? So every customer is your boss, in a sense. So and then managers back up the customers. They say, oh, well, you know, couldn't you just be nice to them, you know, even though the guy groped you or whatever, attacked you. So the management is also sort of complicit in this, whereas in places where the tip minimum wage in the U.S. federally is $2.13 an hour, and it's supposed to be topped up to the minimum wage if you don't get that much in tips, but that really never happens in the restaurant industry. So you're really dependent on tips for your livelihood. In states where there is no lower tips minimum wage, but you know you're getting the minimum wage anyway, you are not as dependent on tips. You do not have to put up with customers treating you
terribly, and so as a result, sexual harassment is less, which is a very interesting sort of way of looking at how sexual harassment works in our society. It works when men have this power over women, and any ways that we can undermine that power will help us.
Yes. Okay, Jenny, I think I'll leave it there, unless there's something else you'd like to add.
No, this was very good. I'm so glad to talk to you about this.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was Jenny Brown speaking about sexual harassment of low-wage workers. She's currently project director for the National Women's Liberation, a dues membership organization with its roots in the women's liberation movement of the 1960s.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong. Take me for granted, leaving love unsure. Makes willpower weak and temptation strong. Should understand she's not just a plaything, she's flesh and blood just like her man. If you wanna do
And you've been listening to the Rape Declaration Forum on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. We broadcast the show twice a month at this time. Follow us on Twitter at radio_RDF, all in caps, or send email to the station.
Let
Thunderbird American Indian Dancers are presenting their 43rd annual concert of music, dance, and storytelling at the Theater for the New City the first two weekends of February. The Thunderbirds perform authentic dances of the Iroquois, Southwest, and Great Plains Native American peoples. Each dance is introduced with a complete explanation of the dance and its culture context, and is accompanied by live music. This unique, educational, and entertaining experience is on Friday, Saturday, and Sundays, February 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 9th, 10th, and 11th, with special admission prices. Theater for the New City is located at 155 First Ave at East 10th Street in the East Village. For tickets and more information, go to theaterforthenewcity.net.
دمع يا بين ريان عنايا والحياة جبنا يجو طلت عشار الدلي بالسلام ريش يزن الدايا بجبن يجو يا غير عظلم من عدم الظلام شروش العيني نرهيجو طلعت يا الزهره بتبسم والقمر والرايا من داجو وي يا طلعت الزهره يا بتبسم القمر والرايا من داجو خاتني منهم يا سهم ورام يا باب يا ابو داجو
ايه ندم القاعدين واللي هربوا خويا يدوم السدر على سي بن حاج العماري، بارك الله بخونا قلب بن حمادي الحبيب المعسكري سعيد بن عربة، واجب الحبيب على حبيب ويسالو.
طاعت الدماء بين النشاط دويت ورفاقتي حبسو، جت في وعدي بك يا سر تميل بس ويغى يبقى صوة
بخاطر كم شيري بيرق وميري انت على ميزون في لامس.
سلمت وعطايا الخمسة سالت عاد الفن وناس يا رشق البيت وبا وقصر بيت من الواسوق يا جات من غياد غناجو يا لبسها يا من غايا للسوام من الحياة في الوايا نخرجو الصدر بخيو يا طت النظام والنهود اخرج رجا رجو كريت خاتم الختام الحنان كحل الزناجو كريت خاتم الختام والحنان كحل الزناجو الشفايف بسواك الدغام والسنان صبايا من عاشو جدي امينا في طيصف عين السيف زين الغطس يكوميتي هذي سنسا دي واحد منه لبسوا يجلبوا بعيون عاسق في جليب المناطيسو جاو في زي العراسق ما يرسد عيهم ما في عرسو يا كي قلو يا علموج موجو يا جاييني مي حبوران من كمين الوهران عرجو فتحين عجايرة الفهم كنجوم صحو بها جو الأيام والشباب يطلق حريجه يا ربيع دعاياهم واللعام هي جول النتايا جهاجه يا عذاب قلب ولاجو يا جول قلبي للجلسة ويجري على خنداريسو كسم صافي بالسباسة وجوهري مع سيول البوسو ونصا وزري عطاسة شاربته بيا الغلاسو الثيامي ناعس عوسى بلافسق يا مقسي قيسو يا
I'm Jesse Lent with the WBAI Resistance Calendar. Saturday, February 10th at 2 p.m., the third annual Black Lives Matter Newark panel discussion will take place at the Newark Public Library at 5 Washington Street in Newark, New Jersey. Moderated by Laurie Scott Pickens, Director of Community Outreach at Rutgers University's School of Criminal Justice, the panel will examine how we got here and the systemic challenges African American families and communities consistently face. You can learn more about this event by calling 973-733-7784 or by sending an email to reference@npl.org. On Thursday, February 15th at 6 p.m., join the New York Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement, or the CAIC for short, in room 220 at NYU Law School's Vanderbilt Hall at 40 Washington Square South between McDougal and Sullivan Street in Manhattan for a lecture on solitary confinement and the incarceration system. According to the CAIC, more than 4,500 people are held in isolated confinement in New York State prisons every day. You can learn more by emailing caicny@gmail.com or by calling 646-294-8331. Also happening on Thursday, February 15th, the event Spirit of Justice, a conversation between Michelle Alexander and Naomi Klein, will take place at 7 p.m. at the Riverside Church at 490 Riverside Drive between West 120th Street and West 122nd Street in Manhattan. Naomi Klein is the best-selling author of No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, and This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Michelle Alexander is a visiting professor of social justice at Union Theological Seminary, as well as a civil rights lawyer, legal scholar, and the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. According to organizers, the two women will discuss what it will take to birth a new America, a nation in which every life and every voice truly matters. Tickets are free, but registration is required in advance. You can get more information by calling 212-662-7100 or by sending an email to online@uts.columbia.edu. The Queer Detainee Empowerment Project is a community organizing group that works with lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, two-spirit, trans, intersex, gender nonconforming,